Welcome to the political scene. I'm Susan Glasser. Russia's invasion of Ukraine grinds on. The war is now in its third brutal month as of this week, with no end in sight. But in ways large and small, the conflict has shifted. At the start of the war, the Russian military hoped to seize Kyiv and decapitate the Ukrainian government, but then quickly retreated in the face of sustained resistance. The fiercest fighting now is in the eastern Donbas region, where cities have been and are continuing to be reduced to rubble. It now seems likely that the war will descend into a stalemate, a brutal war of attrition, as the U.S. National Intelligence Director recently put it, and that the death toll, already in the tens of thousands, will continue to climb. For some valuable perspective from the ground, we're joined today by my colleague Josh Yaffa, who for a long time has been the New Yorker's Moscow correspondent. Throughout the war, he's been reporting from Ukraine and recently published a scorching piece in the magazine about what it's really like under the Russian occupation of a city in southern Ukraine. Hi, Josh, and thanks so much for joining me from Kyiv, no less, where it's finally a beautiful springtime.
Happy to be with you.
Does it seem like the city is still at war to you?
On a certain sense, of course, yes. I think that few people, or really no one in Kyiv, is unaware of the war that's still very much going on in the east, as you mentioned, nor have people forgotten what it was like to live in the shadow of war and under the threat of Russian bombardment from just some months ago. So in the consciousness of people and in the conversations you hear, war is still very much present. But if you just look around town and spend a day walking around or an evening out with some local Ukrainian friends at a restaurant, as I did just before I came to record the podcast, you could be forgiven for forgetting for a few minutes or even a few hours about the war. People in the city have gotten used to this idea that they no longer have to, say, run to bomb shelters at regular intervals or spend the night sleeping in the metro to avoid, you know, shrapnel and collapsing buildings from Russian missile attacks. The city has really come back to life, and beautiful springtime weather doesn't hurt either.
Yeah, well, tell us a little bit about what it's like to be able to report right now from Ukraine. I mean, it's this surreal thing. You're at dinner with friends. The restaurants are open. What kind of restaurant did you go to?
I had a burger. I had a burger and a beer, right? Now the prohibition on alcohol sales was also lifted. Then I was with some friends, some of whom were Ukrainian journalists, and we were sort of comparing notes about who's been where the past months and what the situation is in Kyiv and Kharkiv in the Donbas. And of course, people are following events in the Donbas closely. The situation has gotten worse, noticeably worse for the Ukrainian military just in the past few days. Here we are talking on Wednesday night, and there's been news just in the last day about potential encirclement or approaching encirclement of Ukrainian forces in some key areas in the Donbas. You know, of course, the story of this war so far has been about all of the ways that the Ukrainian military has overperformed in ways that few people expected. But now, I don't want to say that that story is turning in a decisive way. It's not at all that the story has shifted now to the collapse or near loss of Ukrainian forces. Not at all. They're still very much holding out in this concentrated assault on the Donbas. But it does look like Russia is making these kind of piecemeal attrition style, as you said, gains, taking, you know, one town or one highway at a time in the Donbas.
Josh, I'm so glad you pointed that out, because I'm speaking to you today from Washington, where in the wake of the $40 billion extraordinary aid package just passed by Congress last week, the joining by Finland and Sweden of NATO, there's this almost overcorrection that we've seen in the kind of political conventional wisdom here in Washington, and I think potentially in some other Western capitals as well, going from perhaps overestimating Russian strength at the beginning of the war to potentially overestimating Ukrainian strength now. And so I think this sense of what's actually happening on the ground is really important. The other thing I've heard from correspondents, I'm eager to get your sense of this as well, is just how horrible and brutal it is to cover this war. I've talked with friends who have been correspondents all over the world in war zones, in Afghanistan, in Iraq. And, you know, this recalls to them something like Chechnya at its worst days, when you're really in the thick of the fighting. And I'm curious, again, I know you're sitting a brief moment of respite, you know, in the beautiful capital, Kyiv, but covering the war, This is a really brutal war that is taking place on the ground, even if it's not necessarily what you can see every day. Is that right?
Absolutely. And even in my own memory, in the one hand, it seems like a lifetime ago, but in the other, the memory is still fresh. My previous reporting trip to Ukraine in April, I was on the ground in towns and villages outside of Kiev just after Russian forces retreated, covering war crimes. Many of us know the name of cities like Bucha, for example, which has become synonymous with the worst war crimes and atrocities that Russia committed during its initial spring offensive. But in many other towns and villages surrounding Kyiv, a place called Novobykov, for example, where I saw villagers who took me to a cellar where a number of people had been held by Russian forces and taken out to be executed in small groups, to another town, Grybelki, where a woman in her 70s showed me a grave in her garden where she buried her son, who was shot on the doorsteps of their home by Russian forces who advanced and without saying a word, shot at her son, who was standing in the entryway to the house. And there are just stories like that everywhere you go in the villages surrounding Kyiv. And now, increasingly, as Russian troops have also retreated from some villages surrounding Kharkiv, we're hearing similar stories of atrocities from there, not to mention the horrors of a place like Mariupol, which has just been reduced to rubble, really, with its residents either killed in their homes or taken outside to very ominous filtration camps where they're subjected to the worst types of torture and abuse. So, I mean, the degree of violence and the degree of horror and trauma that Ukrainians have lived through, are living through, is immense and hard to get your mind around. And in a way, harder to get your mind around when you come back to Kyiv, as I've done, and you know, go out for dinner with your friends and take a stroll. And what this current phase of the war somewhat reminds me of, though with some key differences, is 2014 and 2015, when I was in Ukraine covering Russia's first invasion of the country in the Donbas, actually, right, where the war is now at its most intense. And back then, the war really did have a local character to it. It was really limited geographically to the Donbas, and so you could go report on what was then a very nasty and brutal and bloody war in the Donbas, but take the train to Kyiv and have a weekend of essentially R&R, strolling around the beautiful capital, as you mentioned, and then, you know, gaining some strength and courage and rest and going back to the Donbas to continue.
Well, this is a totally different war, isn't it, Josh? I mean, like, this is much more almost of a war of extermination. This is a war against the people of Ukraine in a way that 2014 conflict seemed like it was a much more narrowly defined mission that Putin had sent his troops on.
That's right. And what I was going to say is essentially exactly that, is that even though you can be in Kyiv and have a temporary respite from the immediacy of war, you can have a stroll around town and you can have dinner out in a restaurant, there is an awareness that this is a war against Ukraine, that Kyiv is still very much potential future target of Russia. Certainly the kind of entirety of Ukraine's political orientation absolutely remains a goal for Putin in the way it wasn't necessarily in 2014, that this is a war against the totality of a country, against the totality of a people, and that even if there's a moment of relative peace in the capital, that doesn't mean that Russia's aims have in any way kind of narrowed in their ambition, narrowed in their scope, and that if Russia is able to cleave off the Donbas, as it seems to be its major or central military goal at the moment, that doesn't mean the war ends there. That doesn't mean that Russia's aims are somehow limited to particular territorial gains in Donbas. We could talk about an occupation that has gotten less attention, that's gone on really from the first days of the war. I wrote about it a bit in this piece on Melitopol, but that's the cities in the south and east, cities like Kherson, cities like Melitopol, have been occupied for, you know, 2 months now. And there was, in fact, some news today that Putin is going to begin issuing Russian passports to people living in those areas. So a type of creeping annexation is already beginning, and I don't think it's going to end there. It's not going to end necessarily in Donbass. It's not going to necessarily end in the south. This is really a battle of a kind of existential, historical type.
Yeah, I think that's an incredibly important point. It was somewhat lost in the testimony the other day of Avril Haines, the director of U.S. National Intelligence, is exactly the point she was trying to get through in Washington, where it's not necessarily welcome, where everybody always wants a quick fix to everything, right? The senators want to pass a bill with $40 billion worth of assistance to Ukraine and decide that that's going to change the balance of things and end the war, when in fact she was very clear to exactly your point that even if Russia succeeds, as it is still quite possibly going to do, to take over the Donbass, that that will not necessarily, and in fact likely will not be, the end of the war.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So let's talk about that extraordinary piece that you did from occupied Ukraine and what it's like to have the Russians descend upon your state. I thought it really captured this almost World War II-like, you know, sense of what happens when the bad guys, in this case, essentially Russian fascists, march in to your small city, 150,000 people. There's a line there where you have the member of the district council who's trying to talk to one of the occupiers who says, well, we've come to liberate you. And he says, from what? And the young soldier cannot answer. There's betrayal. The deputy of this district council member, I believe, switches sides and essentially is a collaborator. The mayor is arrested, thrown in jail, and then a new mayor is appointed who's willing to collaborate with the Russians. I mean, it's out of something of distant history, and yet it's taking place right now. How did you stumble on this story?
The kidnapping of the mayor of Melitopol, who was a very courageous and adamantly, stubbornly so, Ukrainian patriot who refused to acknowledge, let alone switch sides and work for Russian forces when they entered the town, a man named Ivan Fyodorov, 33 years old, very young, charismatic, precocious Ukrainian politician. He existed for a few days in a strange state of limbo in Melitopol, in which Russian forces left him in office. He formally continued to run affairs in the city, even as he filmed videos in front of a Ukrainian flag, insisting that Melitopol is Ukraine. And that sort of strange limbo in which he was the de jure mayor of town, but de facto the city was occupied by Russian forces, lasted for some days until he was kidnapped by Russian soldiers, taken away, effectively made to disappear. We ultimately later learned he was held in the town's police station that Russian forces occupied and turned into a kind of base. But his kidnapping and forced disappearance turned him into an early national hero in the war. He was one of the figures that Ukrainians really looked to as an example of fortitude in the face of invasion. And so I saw his case when he was eventually released as part of a prisoner exchange. And I was interested in that story about his experience in Melitopol under occupation, his experience in captivity with Russian forces, where he had extended conversations with the soldiers who were guarding him and had the kind of bizarre, almost tragicomic, if the situation wasn't so awful, right, it would almost be funny, the degree of absolute kind of disbelief and misunderstanding and absolute ahistoric understanding of both Ukrainian and Russian history on the part of Russian soldiers who really believe that they're there, say, to liberate Melitopol from fascists. But when Fyodorov, the mayor, asks them to name who are the fascists in Melitopol, of course, the Russian soldiers have no answer. They tell him that Russian speakers in Melitopol are being abused and discriminated against. Fyodorov, who himself is a Russian speaker, says 90% of the residents in town speak Russian, and no one has ever, you know, raised a fuss about that, to which also the Russian soldiers have no answer. Eventually, they settle on the argument that they heard that in Melitopol, veterans of the Second World War are somehow being abused or mistreated, to which Fyodorov replies there are something like, you know, 34, 36 veterans from the Second World War living in Melitopol, and I have all of their numbers saved in my cell phone, and I see them every year on Victory Day. And the Russian soldiers guarding Fyodorov were left in a kind of stupor. They couldn't really explain beyond that what they were doing there. In Bucha, you know, occupation meant the worst types of horrific violence being perpetrated against Ukrainians in Melitopol. There certainly is a lot of violence. I don't want to downplay that element, but there also is a lot of, you know, more almost silly but equally awful cases of collaborationist authorities going into schools and hunting for non-existent so-called nationalist literature in the schools, right? And that's the element I think that indeed gets at this kind of World War II aspect that you mentioned. And I was just really interested to try and get at the fabric of life under occupation and sort of what does it look like, what does it feel like to live in a thoroughly modern, thoroughly Europeanized city like Melitopol and suddenly have Russian troops enter and turn your whole life upside down?
Yeah, I think that your portrait really captures that in a way I have not read yet so far. I also think, though, that your piece suggests where this is headed in terms of Russians settling in for a longer term, call it occupation, call it annexation. And that's where the battlefield and the political battlefield seem to meet up. And you have the stories of not only the collaborationists taking over the local government, but also de-Ukrainizing the schools, looking systematically for independent journalists or those who might be long-term threats to Russian power, trying to get rid of them, and then also establishing filtration camps and having lists of people and deporting them. This is an element that recalls the worst of not only World War II, but also of Russian behavior in previous wars, like in Chechnya. That's when we first heard the phrase about filtration camps and zachistki, cleansing purges, essentially, as a tactic of Russian occupation. Do you think that this is where we're headed, to Russians staying there for a long time in places like Melitopol?
Well, that's certainly what Russia would like. The head of the pro-Kremlin United Russia Party was in Kherson at the beginning of the month, and he announced, you know, Russia is here forever, he said to some local politicians. Clearly a kind of chest-thumping propagandistic statement of intent, but I do think that is in line with the kind of historical messianic element of this war that certainly has been guiding Putin from the beginning, and I think it's sort of filtered down through the military. A different question, of course, is, you know, there are two parties to a war, right? And Russia's intended policy in the south and eastern Ukraine is one thing. I believe it's quite possible that if Russia is able to seize more territory in the Donbass, if it's able to either encircle Ukrainian forces or force them out of, say, the administrative borders of the Donbass region, then we might see Russia try and turn to a defensive posture, might even more actively engage in peace talks than we've seen it. It might actually want a ceasefire. If it can achieve the territorial gains that it finds minimally satisfying, then it might, you know, make sense for Putin to suddenly want to talk about a ceasefire to lock into place those territorial gains. But, you know, why would Ukraine agree to such a ceasefire that even if it brings a temporary end to the assault and bombardment of Ukrainian cities, Ukraine is not going to sign away a significant portion of its territory? I think that we're likely to see some form of Ukrainian counteroffensive later this summer to try and recapture territory in the east and territory in the south. And if Ukraine in coming days is in fact forced to retreat from some strategic cities in the Donbass, I don't think that's a retreat forever. I think that's really a tactical retreat. So I don't think the military phase of this war is over anytime soon. And even if Russia switches to a strategy of trying to mount a long-term protracted defense of these territories in the south and continue the kind of occupation we've been talking about to deepen the hold on places like Melitopol that we've been discussing, it's not going to be able to do that in an unbothered way, right? Whatever plans Putin may have, we've seen over the past few months that Ukraine, and specifically the Ukrainian military, has a say, to put it mildly, right, in how effective or not Russia can be in pulling off its military ambitions in the country.
So have you seen any sign yourself of this much vaunted U.S. aid? Have you seen firsthand any of these javelins or American artillery in action?
Well, so I've certainly spoken with lots of Ukrainian commanders. In fact, I spoke with some military officials today here in Kiev who were telling me about both javelins and stingers, and how both of which, you know, were particularly useful in some of the early battles in the spring and February and March in areas around Kiev, and the particular kind of military tactical advantages of both systems compared to especially their Soviet era predecessors. Javelins and stingers have various technical advantages. You know, stingers can be shot at a longer distance, right? They can reach aircraft farther away than previous generations of anti-aircraft systems. The javelins are also much more effective, and both are much easier to operate. Both require less training than other systems. So that aid really did have an effect in some of the early and decisive battles. If we're talking especially about, for example, preventing the capture of Kiev, I think that American weapon systems were really vital there. You know, I just arrived, as we've spoken about, a couple days ago back to Kiev, so I haven't yet been to the Donbas. So I haven't seen, for example, the American 777 howitzers in action. They've only arrived to Donbas in recent days. The Ukrainian Defense Ministry has published some footage of these howitzers in action firing on Russian positions. So they are very much in the field and very much in action. We've also seen footage published by Ukrainian Special Forces the other day of Switchblade drones attacking a Russian tank. These are American-made drones. They're called loitering munitions. They essentially can hover in the sky for some hours waiting to come across a target. And when they do, they function like kamikazes. They hone in on the target, fire on it, fly at great speed to the target, and then explode, destroying both the target and the drone itself. And so, yeah, these weapons are very much in the field, and the Ukrainian position is essentially, we need these weapons, they're crucial, there are not enough of them, right? The Ukrainian military still says, and credibly so, that it's outgunned. The press office of Zelensky announced just today that by their estimation, in the Donbas, Ukrainian forces are outnumbered 7-1, just in a purely numerical fashion. And some of the military people I was talking to said that in some of the crucial areas in the Donbas, that figure is even greater. Zelensky also, in some separate comments, said that as many as 50 or 100 Ukrainian soldiers every day are being killed in the Donbas during this phase of the campaign. That's really an extraordinary number, and gets at the continued human cost of the war for Ukraine. So as concerns foreign munitions, American, but not only Canadian, French artillery systems are also in the field in the Donbas, the Ukrainians say that they really do provide a necessary technical advantage. Those American-made howitzer systems can fire at further distances than similar Russian systems can. So that gives you a pretty clear tactical advantage if you can be at 40 kilometers distance firing artillery at the enemy, but the enemy needs to be closer than that to fire on you. That immediately gives you an advantage. But just the sheer number and scale of Russian firepower that's been amassed in the Donbas presents a real challenge to the Ukrainians, and is one that has them asking the West, the U.S., but not only, for ever more of this weaponry.
So, Josh, we can't end this conversation without talking about sort of the big other place in the war, which is, you're in Kyiv right now, but of course you spent years living in Moscow, a Moscow that in many ways no longer exists. You know, this is truly for you, for many Western correspondents, the, you know, you can't go home again war. The city that you've known and covered essentially has been cut off from you. In fact, I learned just the other day to my shock that I had been placed on a banned list of Americans. This is in retaliation, I guess, for the rounds of American sanctions on Putin and various Russian government officials, oligarchs, and the like. It's a completely random list. They've got dead Senator John McCain on there. You know, many Republican members of Congress who seem to be relatively pro-Putin as far as one can tell. But, you know, sad for me, but not really practically having an effect, since it's been many years since I was able to be a correspondent based in Moscow, but for you and the other journalists who have risked so much to tell the story of Putin's Russia, the door is essentially slammed shut, right? You can't write about a war that you're not even allowed to call a war in Russia today. Tell us about what you think the future will be for actual reporting from inside Russia. How are we going to know what's going on in Putin's Russia as this horrible conflict plays out?
Well, yeah, I was sorry to learn of your being banned from Russia, though you're in a, as you say, a strange but also illustrious group in falling under that sanction. And hope that in due time you'll be able to go back to Russia where you've done such great reporting. And I certainly have the same plan. I don't think of myself as being banned from Russia. I don't think of myself either being in either self-imposed or externally imposed exile. You know, as long as there's an opportunity to safely and credibly report from Russia, I plan to take advantage of that opportunity. That said, I'm not, you know, naive or Pollyannish about what the reporting environment inside Russia is like. I mean, first and foremost, there has been the series of laws, most notably one that makes illegal the dissemination of so-called fakes, in quote, or fake information about the activity of Russian armed forces abroad, punishable by up to 15 years in prison. So, of course, that makes everyone sit up straight, not just foreign journalists, but first and foremost Russian journalists who are covering this war. And even the very fact, as you mentioned, of calling this war a war is potentially already, you know, puts you in violation of this law, because in Russia, of course, it's not a war, but a special military operation. So for the time being, it's difficult to the point of impossible to speak and write or publish credibly, openly, honestly about the war and about Russia's conduct in the war. But you know, Russian journalists, first and foremost, have impressed me over the years with their courage, resilience, fortitude. And I think that we'll continue to see that. And as you've mentioned, you know, the story from inside Russia is no less important to understanding the nature of this war, the outcome and future of this war. And I continue to follow the work of my brave, intrepid, talented Russian colleagues, some of whom are still in Moscow, many of whom have settled abroad but maintain their sources inside the country. So the future of journalism is certainly difficult and perhaps even bleak, but we've said that so many times about Russia because it's been true. It's been true so many times in the course of Putin's Russia, yet somehow journalists, mainly Russian ones, have found a way to continue to work, and I hope I can continue to do the same.
Josh, you know, that's such an important note, maybe even if it's not going to happen, of optimism to leave this conversation on. I saw a clip the other day of a group of thousands, or it looked like, you know, hundreds at least, of young Russians in St. Petersburg shouting, bleep the war, bleep the war. And I thought, well, you know, we don't know if this reporting is reaching them or not, but, you know, not everybody is just rolling over and accepting it. So thank you for your optimism, for your reporting from the ground, from Ukraine, and for telling the stories of something that would be almost unbelievable if you weren't and others weren't risking their lives to tell these stories. So thank you again for joining us from Kyiv tonight, Joshua Yaffa.
My pleasure.
Joshua Yaffa is a contributing writer at The New Yorker and the author of Between Two Fires, Ambition and Compromise in Putin's Russia. This has been The Political Scene. I'm Susan Glasser. The show is produced by Michelle Moses and Kylie Warner. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. Thank you so much for listening.